It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll talk to World War Z author Max Brooks about the state of the horror genre on this Halloween.
First, a scan of the news may suggest that there's plenty to be spooked about these days, even without Halloween dishing its brew of ghosts, goblins, and witches.
Scary viruses, terrorist insurgencies, airplane crashes can put us on alert, but how much of what makes us scared is based in real fear, and how much of it is psychology?
For example, fears about Ebola have reached mass proportions in the U.S., according to a recent Washington Post ABC News poll. Two-thirds of Americans are worried about a widespread Ebola outbreak. Some people say the media and politicians are stoking fear-bola by making alarmist statements about the disease.
With us now is Olga Hazan. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote an article in The Atlantic today called The Psychology of Irrational Fears. Olga, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Ebola, it's a real thing. It's kind of a scary disease. But is our fear, our worry about it, out of proportion here in the U.S.?
Well, it is a scary disease, but, I mean, it doesn't pose quite as big of a threat as, say, the flu does or, you know, any number of other things, car accidents, for example, that are far more likely to hurt us. And so part of this is just that it's a very unfamiliar thing. It's not something we've had here before this year. And things that are unfamiliar or seem kind of foreign tend to be scarier to us than things that are more familiar.
And what is the psychology behind that, that the unfamiliar but remote risk is more powerful than the one we face maybe every day, like a flu or a car crash?
Right. Well, so I think part of it is just like kind of an inability to understand odd ratios, right? So if, let's say, you know that there's a very small chance of getting Ebola, people may focus on, you know, what if I'm that one person who does accidentally sit next to the person on the subway who has Ebola, and then I'll get it too. And that's how they get to be, you know, afraid to leave their house and things like that. And then, you know, just in general, it's something where there's a lot of misinformation out there, and you still have people saying, what if, you know, it gets, you know, to be air transmissible, and what if it changes in some way and becomes more contagious? So that kind of thing can really spread and make us more afraid.
Who do you see as spreading some of that misinformation of overhyping the fear?
Well, there's just been a couple of examples. I mean, I've been kind of in and out watching some of these Ebola hearings, and there's a few lawmakers who have said things that are not quite true. Like Rand Paul said that if someone has Ebola at a cocktail party, they're contagious and you can catch it from them, which of course is only true if they're symptomatic, in which case they probably wouldn't be at a cocktail party. You know, and there's been several kind of calls to close the border because immigrants are bringing Ebola in with them. But of course, people in Mexico don't have Ebola. You know, there's just a lot of different statements out there that are a little bit far-fetched.
Well, some people are saying, okay, yes, it's remote risk, but how about better safe than sorry? Let's take this super seriously, err on the side of caution, and so on. What is the problem with that?
I mean, the problem with it is that when we, you know, sometimes when we kind of are overly afraid of something, it actually can increase the risk of something bad happening. So an example of that is like parks tend to get more dangerous when people avoid them out of fear because, you know, the empty park will encourage criminals to kind of move in. So in the case of Ebola, for example, we've had the example of the travel ban or the quarantine, which experts say would only hurt the volunteer efforts in West Africa because you couldn't get personnel and supplies over there as easily.
Now, you mentioned in your piece a phrase I hadn't heard before, instructional fear acquisition. If we hear something should be scary, over time we'll find it scary, whether or not we did initially. Can you talk a little more about that?
Sure. So this is a sort of this theory that, you know, we kind of learn our fears from people around us. So if you are a child and you see your mom, you know, freak out because she sees a lizard, you might start to develop a fear of lizards, even though lizards are not necessarily harmful to you. And actually this could go back as far as, you know, being if from when you're a fetus and you kind of, you know, learn kind of from your mom in that way. And then also newborns can learn fear through the odor of their mothers, from the kind of odors that they give off when they're distressed. And so that's like one way that we kind of learn to be afraid of things.
And so looking at the media and this idea of fear acquisition, even if all the media coverage was perfectly responsible and even keeled and so on, is there something about the sheer quantity of it by covering it a lot that might lead to this kind of fear acquisition?
Well, it can sort of, it can sort of spread among people. So as people get more anxious, anxiety tends to kind of spread. So this is what's called mass psychogenic illness, where people kind of avoid things like gluten or vaccines or windmills because other people do. So it can have sort of like a wall-to-wall effect where suddenly everyone's worried about Ebola, so you become worried about it too. And the fact that it's here now and the fact that it's in, there's been cases in our hospitals, he was traveling in our subway, that too can kind of, heighten the kind of fear of this and make it kind of feel more scary to people.
You touched a little bit on hypochondria too, and you mentioned it just a bit earlier. Do we see a lot of cases so far of people worried, do I have Ebola, even though they haven't been anywhere near somebody who's had it?
Well, I haven't read specific kind of examples of hypochondria in that way, but there has been some interesting hypochondria in kind of the public sphere. So one example that I found was a school board in North Carolina recently asked their assistant principal to work from home for 21 days after she got back from South Africa on a mission trip. And of course, South Africa is very far from West Africa, where the current outbreak is centered. So it's that kind of thing where, obviously the parents were upset, they pushed back, and they asked them to have, this person work from home so as not to expose the children, even though there was virtually no risk.
You also compare fear of Ebola in the news a lot with, common and recurring fears we hear about shark attacks, even though last year, I think you wrote that the U.S. shark fatality total was zero. Did I read that right?
Right. So the statistic I found was that there hasn't been a shark attack death in the U.S. since 2012. But actually, 30,000 people at least die in car accidents every year. It's just kind of, but which are you, kind of more worried about if you go to the beach and hear that there might be sharks in the area or, getting in your car and driving? So it's just another one of those examples of how something being unfamiliar or kind of, being associated with a scary idea tends to make it more threatening, even though it's actually not.
Do you think there's value in trying to understand how we get our fears wrong or at least out of proportion and be aware of our inability to assess risk and that might help us assess it better down the road?
Yeah, I think especially when it comes to public policy discussions, when you're talking about travel bans or mandatory quarantines, you do have a lot of psychology that goes into those, right? I mean, a lot of these hearings and these discussions are driven by fear. And if we try to understand, is this overblown? Are we not recognizing the actual risk? Are we kind of acting more on our emotions than on what would actually happen? It can lead to bad policy outcomes, and that can actually make, the thing that is scary, which is Ebola in West Africa, even scarier.
Olga, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Olga Hazan. She is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote a piece on our irrational fear and how it relates to our reaction to Ebola.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Happy Halloween. We have a special treat for you today. Horror author Max Brooks is with us to talk about the latest edition of his comic series, Extinction Parade, and why we need zombies now more than ever.
Max Brooks is the author of World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. He's also the author of the comic series, Extinction Parade. Max, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Well, you've got this ongoing series, The Extinction Parade. I understand some people around the country were getting free copies of it in a pre-Halloween celebration. Tell us what Extinction Parade is all about.
Extinction Parade officially is about a zombie outbreak told through the eyes of vampires. And what it really is a study of privilege and what happens when a species is at the top of the food chain and how it's robbed them of the survival skills that the weaker human race has been building over the course of its evolution.
Well, right, and your vampires have been living the good life for thousands of years. They're aristocrats. They're kind of soft. Are they ready for this?
They are not ready for this. Initially, they actually like the zombie outbreak because they like the chaos. And then they realize slowly and carefully that they have an inconvenient truth, which is, what are they going to eat when all the humans are gone?
And now, this sounds like a series where humans exist mainly as a contested food source. Do we have human heroes, or are they kind of on the sidelines here?
Yeah, they are definitely on the sidelines. The humans are trapped in between the growing zombie plague and these apex predator vampires.
Now, why did you choose to tell this story as a graphic novel?
You know, it's a visual story, and I always wanted it to be told in comic book format. I think it's also more important for younger viewers or younger readers, because I think I think it's important for every generation coming up to understand the power of struggle and how failure actually makes you stronger and better, as opposed to just living the good life. I think when things are handed to you, you're completely unprepared for adversity.
And when you were on to talk about World War Z a while back, you talked about, in part, yeah, it's a zombie story, but it's also a story about human infrastructure and planning and choices we make. Do you hope, and you just kind of mentioned our reaction to adversity, do you hope that we'll take this and maybe rethink the way we live our lives, teach our kids?
You know, I hope so. As a parent, I'm watching a whole generation of young people growing up where both soccer teams are given trophies, and parents actually go to job interviews now with their kids. And I thought, how is that helping them when they're not being allowed to fail and pick themselves back up? I grew up seeing what happens to the kids who had it easy, and they do not make for good adults.
Do you think there are other real-world applications here? I'm thinking about a story I read that last year General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, read your book World War Z and took it to the rest of the Chiefs of Staff and said, we need to be prepared for a zombie attack. I mean, do you think there are real-world applications here, even though we're messing around in the world of fantasy and horror?
Oh, no, definitely, because I think that even if the catalyst, the enemy, is fictional, which is zombies, the preparation is very real. People ask me if I have a zombie preparedness kit, and I say, yeah, it's just my earthquake kit. It's all the same stuff. You know, with Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, I sort of talk about physical preparedness. And with Extinction Parade, I talk about emotional and psychological preparedness, sort of what do you need in your heart and your soul to be ready when things fall apart.
Well, now, if we are living a reasonably good life and not running into adversity and we can't go out and find a zombie attack, how can we train ourselves in adversity to be ready for bigger adversity?
Well, I think taking risks, and I think embracing failure instead of running away from it, and I think seeing every failure as a chance to get smarter and stronger and more resilient, because the truth is it's not about how awesome you are. It's how resilient you are.
Do the humans get a chance to be resilient, or are they just sort of the pawns, at least
in
your new series?
Well, humans actually are resilient. That's the point of the story, is that initially vampires sort of look down on them as the biological peasants, as the weaker species, and then they slowly come to realize that it's their weaknesses that have made them strong. It's the compensating for those weaknesses that have made them more resilient, and that the humans have an emotional, psychological survival kit that the vampires just never had.
Is there an environmental stewardship angle here, the vampires realizing that they may have reached peak human and have to start taking action?
No, definitely. And I think that's an important point, because initially the zombies ignore the vampires. And that's important because that's the danger of ecological disaster. You know, nobody's going to directly die from climate change, but they're going to die from all the secondary and tertiary problems caused by climate change. And that's the problem with the vampires. Initially, they ignore the threat until, like I said, they have their inconvenient truth and realize, oh, it's not that the zombies directly threaten us, but they threaten our food source.
I want to see the vampire Al Gore's PowerPoint presentation now.
Oh, there's a whole issue of that where we literally have our vampire Al Gore.
Nice.
Who stops the vampires in the middle of a blood orgy to explain to them that we're all going to die unless we get our act together.
So humans, vampires, zombies, it seems like there's a lot of overlap here. I mean, do you think in a way, I don't know, in a sort of a lit major way, they're all the same person, they're all the same thing?
Well, I think they can be sort of whatever you want them to be. You know, with me growing up watching vampires sort of be worshipped as these sleek and sexy super beings, I took away something very different from the exact same stories, which was they don't have a job.
Well, turning to more kind of World War Z real world crossovers, you wrote earlier this month that you've been asked to compare Ebola to your work in World War Z. You said when it comes to the world's response to Ebola, you're encouraged. You're seeing a lot more positives as compared to how you portrayed things in World War Z. How so?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think Ebola, the response to Ebola is getting a lot of negative press because that sensationalism and that sells. But the truth is, in my lifetime, I've rarely seen world governments come together so swiftly and massively as in the case of Ebola. I mean, the fact that the U.S. Army is sending 4,000 troops to Africa, the fact that the U.N. is starting to analyze the economic impact of Ebola, all these new measures are being put into place. I mean, this is something I certainly have not seen in a long time.
There are, you know, Ebola is one thing, but there's a lot of scary stuff happening in the real world right now. There are the journalist beheadings. There are our wars, you know, Ebola itself. Do we need this genre right now more than ever? Or do you think, on the other hand, maybe there's enough horror already?
Well, I think we do need the genre more than ever because it allows us one step back from the truth in that real horror triggers our psychological defense mechanism. I think it's human nature that when a threat is too real, such as Ebola or ISIS, people tune out. They don't want to hear it. It's too scary. But if you present these facts with the veneer of science fiction or horror, then it allows people to still sleep at night and hopefully digest some of the lessons from the real world.
As we mark Halloween, what are your favorite horror books and movies? What do you look to maybe to watch again and again on this holiday?
I don't think I can ever get enough of George Romero's original Dawn of the Dead. I think it's an amazing parable for his entire generation of baby boomers. It really tracks their sort of descent into mindless consumerism. And I've always said that I think it should be sold in a box set with Easy Rider. It should be called The Baby Boomers, The Beginning and the End.
So is that something you think is true of your work, too? Are you in that tradition where the zombies are sort of a mark of heedless consumerism?
I don't know about consumerism. I try to put real-world social commentary into my work. I don't want it just to be slasher hacker. I'm always trying to say something more, something deeper. I'm trying not to be too preachy, but I would like to follow in his footsteps. So whether I do a good job or not, that's up for the world to decide.
Is there room for the slasher hacker realm with maybe no hidden meanings behind it?
Well, there's no room in my world. Hmm. I have no patience for mindless entertainment or torture porn. I like a little bit of, I guess, intellectual nutrition in my action. And it doesn't have to be heavy-handed. You know, Jaws, I thought, was a great example of capitalism run amok, but at the end of the day, it was still a giant shark eating people.
Well, for a long time, it was vampires sitting on the throne in the horror world. Zombies kind of ousted them. They're the big popular monster right now. Why do you think that is? If we take your idea that we get the monster of our time. We're into the one that speaks to us. What is it about zombies that speak to us right now?
I think the apocalyptic nature of zombie stories, I think they allow us to sort of explore the apocalypse without it becoming too real. I think when people see a movie like Contagion or read a book like The Road by Cormac McCarthy, I think it's too real. I think people shut them out. But if you see a good zombie story, you're still seeing exactly what would happen in a Hurricane Katrina. But you are able to see it because it's zombies.
Now, you've got Extinction Parade ongoing. You had the Harlem Hellfighters come out, I think, earlier this year. What's next? What's your next project in the works?
There's a couple projects. The Harlem Hellfighters, the true story of the 369th African-American unit in World War I, the movie rights for that has been optioned by Will Smith's company, and I'm currently writing the screenplay. So that was literally 16 years in production. So hopefully it'll see the big screen sometime in the future.
Max, what are you going to be for Halloween?
I am going to be the father of Charlie Chaplin.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
That was Max Brooks, author of World War Z and the Zombie Survival Guide. He's also the author of the comic series Extinction Parade and the graphic novel The Harlem Hellfighters. By the way, right now at the Central Time Facebook page, we are looking to find out your favorite horror movies of all time. Head over there, share your thoughts. Great scary movies, past or present. Maybe something you're going to watch today or this weekend.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's Food Friday, and our guest chef is drawing inspiration from his Native American heritage to come up with recipes, ingredients, and inspiration for a pre-colonization diet.
Sean Sherman joins us now. He's a chef, also known as the Sous Chef, and he's planning to open a restaurant this winter in the Twin Cities. Sean, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, you're at the forefront of a new food movement. It's been called the pre-colonization cuisine, food that early Native American peoples would have eaten. And I wonder if we could start by having you describe what that means and what that means for you as a chef.
Okay, well, I had started this concept quite a few years back. I grew up on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. I'm a member of the Oglala Lakota Sioux tribe. So with this restaurant concept that I've built called the Sioux Chef, I'm focusing on Native American food in general, but like you guys were saying, pre-reservation diets. So my focus is what people were eating that I've always been here for a long time. So it was, for me, it was a large study on all the wild foods and flavors that are out there in these forest and lake regions and rivers, and also a lot of just the history, because right where I'm at in Minneapolis, particularly the Dakota Sioux tribe, they grew a large farms, and they had lots of produce that were readily available throughout the season. So my main focus was trying to recreate some of these old pantries, and you know, I've studied enough and got far enough where I really realized I could create an entire restaurant utilizing, you know, almost 100% just indigenous products from just this region in particular.
When did you realize that really no one else was cooking this way?
Well, there are a few other Native chefs around the country, kind of on the same path that I am. But when I had started, I would say right around 2008 or so, I started this journey going into thinking about doing a Lakota cookbook, and I thought it'd be fun to, you know, do some modernized plating versions of some Lakota foods. And as I started to research, I realized how little information was out there. Pretty much whatever I found as far as recipe goes, usually dealt with fry bread or commodities, or it was very Southwestern, which was great, but I was looking for just this particular region up in these areas. So I just really kind of devised my own learning plan of what I thought I needed to know to try to figure out the foods of my own heritage. So I started studying the wild foods, learning how to identify the plants, reading histories, reading about what people were gathering, reading about how people were building their food pantries over the long summer to prepare themselves for the even longer winter and make sure that they had a varied diet to get them through that long cold spell.
Now, it's interesting to me. Here we are. We're in the middle of a local foods boom, where that's a big watchword among foodie circles. Why do you think it was that authentic Native American cooking wasn't really done anywhere else? And also, you had to actually work to track down its history.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate that this food culture just hasn't been around. You know, it surprises a lot of people. You know, I always tell people, especially in the city, at first I'll tell them that I'm focusing on Native American food, and a lot of times they aren't really sure what that means. And after a little bit of explanation, they get where I'm coming from, where I'm going to. And I'll tell them, like, you can go out in the city here in Twin Cities and find cuisine from all over the world within the city. Like, name a country and you'll find it. But you can't find the cuisine that came from our particular area. And it's kind of like that across the board, unfortunately. I mean, there have been and are a few Native American restaurants, but I don't know if anybody's pushed so hard to regionalize it like I'm focusing on with just the Dakota and Ojibwe in my area for this first restaurant. I just want to show people how varied the entire country is, diet by diet, through all the indigenous people around us. So.
As part of your research, Sean, did you do oral history? Did you talk to older people in the tribes to try to track down what they had maybe eaten as kids?
Yeah, and a little. You know, I have, and I grew up on the reservation, so we learned some stuff growing up. And I have an uncle who's a professor, and he had taught out in Fort Collins, Colorado, quite a bit. But he really studied the ethnobotany side of things around the Black Hills region. So I spoke with him a lot about the wild foods out in those regions. And then for the most part, I just kind of devised my own plan and really started moving forward. And when I was looking back in history, I was looking for a lot of first contact information to see if there was any pictures of what people were, like words just to show what people were eating and how they were processing the foods. And so it's been a long journey, but it's been, definitely rewarding. And I knew this year was the year that I really wanted to come out and do it. So I started my company up in April, and I officially started pushing forward trying to open up the restaurant just this September. So it's moving along pretty fast.
Now, I read that you spent 6 years learning about this cuisine, and you also sounds like honed your skill set a little bit, too. You learned about foraging and smoking meat. How did you teach yourself about those things?
Well, I've been a chef for quite a long time in the city, so a lot of the pieces I had, basic background training in. So, I've done lots of smoking. I've tried lots of different cuisines around the world, and I have been able to practice a lot of different styles through my culinary career. So for me, I just kind of applied my own self-education to what I was doing with Native American foods, and in particular, learning about the foods of the Dakota and the Ojibwe, and also some of my heritage with the Lakota. But, what I really would like to do is get this first model restaurant open and then help open similar model restaurants around other parts of the state and the country down the road. So.
Let's get into some of the ingredients that you're using that might be new to us, those of us who haven't tried this type of cooking. Let's start with the plant world, because that's where you did a lot of your research. What kind of plant ingredients?
Sure. Well, there's a lot. When I started studying and when I realized what people were growing on farms, a lot of people are really familiar with the indigenous flavors already. So I am able to build an entire staple out of, the different varieties of corn, beans, and squash. And a lot of these heirloom varieties are being regrown again today, especially in my area. There's a couple of native-run farms that are starting to regrow this stuff. But, there's tons of berries out there. There's the chokecherries. And, here we have pretty much every berry that grows through that you can think of just, pops up throughout the summer season. I've been using a lot of tree food. It seems to be one of the foods that people have stopped using. So I've been using a lot of cedar, birch syrup, white pine, balsam fir, things like that as ingredients and flavor agents for food. I've been using a lot of sumac. I've been using a lot of rose hips. I've been pulling, as much as I can out of the wild, and wild ginger that grows all over the place out here too. So I've just been really trying to, find and preserve and utilize a lot of these flavors just to showcase, how rich in flavor these areas are to us.
You mentioned tree foods and trees like cedar and pine. Can you give us an example of how you might use those in a dish?
Well, I have been using a bit of the cedar. I've been using red cedar around here, and I will just the greener that is, the more flavor it has, I found. So I've been making a lot of teas for people, just like cedar and sweetened with a little bit of maple. But I've also been using it straight up as an herb. So I just chop up a little bit of the green part and add that to dishes or mix it in with food. So I've made like a walleye seasoned with a little bit of chopped up cedar and fresh wild ginger. And maybe a little touch of sumac. All this stuff grows all over the place out here. And the great thing about these tree foods, especially those evergreens, is they're so high in vitamins. So if you think about, the long winters, and there's not a lot of fruit growing, of course, in these cold, cold winters, but they're just surrounded by all this great vitamin C, and people were utilizing those a long time ago.
And I've also seen reference to using purslane, which I was once pulling as a weed. I didn't know what it was. And a neighbor said, stop
right.
that. If you're going to throw that away, I'll just come over and pick all your purslane because I'm going to eat that. What is purslane's all over the place. What does it taste like and what can we do with it?
Purslane's great. And, sometimes I found it to be extremely citrusy, especially on the stem part of it. So I like to use the whole plant, basically, because it's just really tender. I believe purslane has been introduced from Europe at a certain point in time. And there are plants that have been introduced that aren't fully indigenous, but have been here since, you know, the early 1500s. So they pretty much well acclimated themselves pretty well across the United States. And they're great food sources, and they have tons of vitamins. But I use purslane all the time just as a fresh piece because you see it growing everywhere. And, you know, it's funny that some chemical companies will spend so much money to develop a chemical to kill just that one piece, you know. Hmm.
Well, can you give us a little bit of a sample menu here? We've talked a little bit about the greens in the plant world, but if you were putting together a tasting menu at the restaurant, what would you give people?
Well, the restaurant that I have designed, so I have gotten a lot of press lately, and there's been a lot of, you know, really nice pictures of modern stylings of these Native American flavors. And I have done quite a few of those dinners, but the restaurant itself I designed to be a family-style restaurant because I want to make it approachable for everybody, whether they're Native or non-Native, and I wanted to not have any pretensions when you go in there. So it's just all about this really clean, great food and these flavors. So it's some of this stuff is just so simple, like sunchokes with honey and sunflower seed, or, you know, sweet potatoes, different kinds of roasted squash, or I'm cooking smoked walleye or whitefish, braising rabbit with, again, like cedar or white pine or juniper, lots of things like that. So I designed the menu so when you come to the restaurant, you'll be able to come with a family or a large group and, you know, order bits and pieces off the menu that everybody gets to try and share and pass around. And I feel that's more in tune with the Native American style of food anyway. So I just want it to be really comfortable for everybody that comes in and really just appreciate how clean and flavorful all this food is with, you know, it's a very minimalistic approach to cooking because I'm just using a few key ingredients and kind of letting all the food speak for itself.
We're talking to Sean Sherman, also known as the Sous Chef. He's telling us about his effort to cook and promote pre-colonization foods using indigenous ingredients from North America.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what this kind of cooking involves or about Native American foods? And do you have a personal experience eating this kind of food? If you forage or you harvest some of the ingredients we're talking about now, how have you used them in your own cooking? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Sean Sherman. He's a chef who's specializing in a pre-colonial diet using indigenous ingredients and recipes inspired by his Native American heritage.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the ingredients Sean is talking about? Do you have personal experience with these kinds of foods in your own life? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. And Sean, you sent us a recipe that we're going to put up in a little while on the Central Time Facebook page, duck and wild rice pemmican. Can you tell us a little about that?
Pemmican is kind of like an energy food that had been done. You see this recipe quite a bit if you look into Native American food. In this region, we also called it, there was another very similar one called wasna, which is kind of the same thing where they just took dried meats, usually some berries or maybe some other ingredients and kind of, mix it all up. So I kind of used some of the flavors from the forest up here. So some, dried duck, basically just making it from scratch. So if you have a food dehydrator, just drying it out, separating the fat off of it before you cut it up and dehydrate it, rendering that fat out to use that in the recipe a little bit later on, and then just mixing up some dried berries. So in the recipe, I use blueberries there, and then also I use some wild rice because it's a great grain, and it's all over Minnesota here, and just puffing it up. So if you cook it in a little bit of oil, it kind of puffs up like popcorn. You'll even, some of the kernels will even kind of pop out and look like a little tiny popcorn, but it's a great way to make a quick snack out of fresh dry wild rice. And then just basically mixing all that together. So, you know, this was kind of the kind of food that people were able to put in a little pouch and, you know, go on a long hike or horse ride or boat ride or whatnot and be able to have this great energy food that just kind of packs a punch. So I thought that was just kind of a real fun, simple recipe. I mean, it's a little bit of work, but, you know, it's pretty rewarding once you put it all together.
And we'll take our caller now. We have John on the line from La Crosse. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. I'm just extremely enthusiastic about your restaurant, and I'm very anxious to try it. I'm calling from La Crosse. I have to drive a ways, but boy, just let me know where it is, and I'm on my way. I'm extremely interested in Native Americans. I just returned from Chaco Canyon. I think most Americans don't know a lot about the Native American cultures that were thriving at the time the Europeans arrived. The Chaco Canyon, the Pueblo people, and the people in southern Illinois, I've forgotten the name of that, where the big pyramids are. People don't know. There was a lot going on, and I'm extremely anxious to try your food.
Okay. You've got a customer there already, Sean. When is your restaurant going to be open?
Well, I'm shooting for this winter, so it could be as soon as late December, and it could be as late as March. So it'll happen this winter before spring.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, I know this is a restaurant idea that you're hoping will be successful, but you're also trying to help revive the food culture of tribes in the region from Wisconsin to the Dakotas. Can you talk about why that's important to you to do?
Well, you know, when I started researching and realizing there wasn't a lot of written information down on this subject, I just kind of made it my journey to keep pushing forward and try to find as much information to help revitalize. I think it'd be really important to, I hate to say that the food culture was lost, but it was kind of just put on the wayside. So a lot of people stopped using a lot of these traditional flavors and traditional ways of utilizing food. Like, you know, we don't see people drying fish. We don't see a lot of people making birch syrup anymore. We don't see a lot of people using the trees for teas, things like that. And, you know, I just trying to help people just in my particular region right now, because I'm not trying to tell people, you know, all over the country what Native American food is. I just kind of want to focus where I am, you know, using some of my background and, you know, applying it to other people in regions and histories in this area too. I mean, it's so diverse because even, you know, from here to Green Bay, I was working with a chef out in Green Bay. His name is Arlie Dockstater, and he's also been, you know, pushing Native American cuisine with his stuff and, you know, using a lot of his Oneida white corn and coming up with some fun recipes on that side. So, you know, even just from across the state, you know, from me to over there, you know, the foods already start to change and it's already becoming more different with what's available. And there's definitely similarities, but, you know, I just really think it's important for people not only to understand that there is a Native American food culture and it can be strong, and I just want to be a part of helping that to grow and maybe inspire more young people to, you know, take hold of their traditions and heritage and, you know, help make it thrive down the road.
Sean, I've read that some tribes are using this pre-colonialism sort of diet to help people on the reservation be healthier. Is this a good way of eating to try if it's just for health reasons?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, I'm not using any processed sugars. I'm not even using any beef, chicken, or pork. But there's plenty of proteins out there for me. There's plenty of fats to use. I'm not using olive oils or vinegars. So the food itself is so clean. It's so fresh. You know, and it's basically, you know, eating with the seasons too. So they're all throughout the summer season and growing season, you know, you're getting all this fresh food, but you're also, you know, part of it is being smart and preserving a lot of it to last. So you have a lot to cook with during the winter time. But, you know, the food is low salt, low fat, and it's gluten-free for those kind of diets. You know, people who are on paleo diets, I'm not using any dairy or anything. So it really falls in line with a lot of the current food diet fads that are out there right now. Just naturally, because it just had all of that built into it. So it's a very clean diet. And, you know, especially with high diabetes on reservations, I think that it's really important to eat this really, you know, clean food that is low in sugar. You know, because I use a lot of maple sugar. I wouldn't say a lot, but I use a good amount of it. But that's low glycemic, you know, and the only other sweetener I really use are berries or honey. So, you know, all in all, it's a really, really healthy way if people want to go for that diet just for that. You know, it's lean meats and, you know, everything it kind of fits in perfectly with everybody's diet.
Let's go back to our callers. You've got Irma on the line in Appleton. Irma, hi.
Hi there. So you mentioned a spice called sumac. And I'm originally, I'm Middle Eastern. I've been in Washington for 16 years, but I grew up on Suma. So the question was, is there any connectivity? Is it a Native American spice that has traveled the world somehow, or is it connected? Maybe it's a different spice, and I don't know.
Huh. Sumac in Middle Eastern. Go ahead, Sean. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Yeah, the sumac is it's a cousin to what everybody uses in the Middle East, you know, which is widely used over there because they have it in spice mixes like sitar, and it's just used all over. And we use it very similar here because you see staghorn sumac everywhere you go. So if you're out on the highways, you know, especially right now in the fall season, they just stand out. They're just those little red fronds that are sticking up all over the highway. You know, and it's the red dust on the outside that kind of gives it that nice citrusy flavor. So it's a real lemony tart flavor to use. People used to make a lemonade type drink out of it just by soaking it for a long time. And, you know, they'd sweeten it a little bit, but it's just a really nice tart flavor to use. And it grows wild all over the place out here. So I use it all the time.
Irma, thanks a lot for the call. And another one here from Leela in Woodville. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay, I was wondering, I've done some research on using milkweed, and I wondered if that was part of Native American tradition or not.
You know, we used milkweed kind of when we were kids. You know, they taught us just to put it like on bee stings and stuff like that, or mosquito bites, but I haven't used milkweed as personally as a food agent. I've come across it in a couple of books, but I haven't personally played with it yet.
Thanks a lot for the call. Sean, you've been a chef for a long time in a variety of genres. Does it feel different to you to cook the food that's so connected to your heritage, to your ancestors?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, once I really started on this journey, I was so focused on just finding more and more about this food. And every time I'd have a big discovery or discovered a new flavor that I could use, it'd just be so exciting. And then, you know, it really changed my perspective when I'd go out in the forest and I'd just start seeing food everywhere. And it's very exciting to me. And, you know, I hope people can also appreciate it. And I think they will because the timing's so right with, you know, how the local and organic fad has really, you know, pushed food culture into a whole different way of, you know, eating fresh and eating local. But, you know, all the other food cuisines, you know, I wouldn't say I stopped caring about, but, you know, nothing was comparing to what I was discovering with this kind of cuisine because, you know, for me, it's just something that just wasn't readily available. So it's just making discoveries. So it's kind of like taking a broken pot and putting it together piece by piece, starting to see a whole picture as we go forward. But yeah, I think it's really exciting. I think it's really exciting to see other Native chefs across the country, like Chef Nephi Craig in Arizona. He's been working really hard with his White Mountain Apache foods, and it's fun to watch him grow also on a very parallel path.
All right. Sean, you know, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
That's Sean Sherman. He's also known as the Sous Chef. We've got his recipe, duck and wild rice pemmican. That's going to be on the Central Time Facebook page later today. He has a restaurant opening this winter in the Twin Cities.
I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. News is next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.